Please be advised this podcast contains content of a graphic, violent nature. It's not appropriate for children.
This is Australian True Crime with Michelle Laurie and Emily Webb. Come with us as we go beyond the news cycle to find out how people become killers, how people become victims, and what happens next. This is Australian True Crime with Michelle Laurie and Emily Webb.
People, when they're in distress, talk a load of rubbish and make all sorts of wild threats, but you never really imagine that they're capable of doing them. But people are capable. It's like a piano, you know, where there's all those keys up in there. Most people play the ones in the middle and the safe chords get played over and over, but we could still go to either end if we really wanted to.
Megan Norris is a journalist and best-selling author. Her book, On Father's Day, was the subject of an earlier episode of Australian True Crime. It's a brilliant book written with the blessing and the assistance of Cindy Gambino, whose ex-husband, Robert Farquharson, murdered their three sons by driving them into a dam on Father's Day in 2005. Megan is old school in her meticulous approach to writing about true crime because she worked her way up, all the way up, from a cadetship with a local paper to become a leading crime reporter. It's a system that produced many of the great storytellers of our time, but sadly, it seems gone forever as newsrooms the world over downsize. Not so long ago, those rooms were bustling with ambitious young reporters jealously protecting scoops, leads and informants. So let's take a trip back now to the glory days of print journalism with Megan Norris.
I started covering court when I was really young. So I joined a newspaper in 1977 as one of two token girl cadets in England. We were told that, you know, you two won't last till Christmas. They said I'd be first because the other girl was prettier and more sophisticated and I rode a bike. I'd be kicked out. And I remember thinking, oh, and digging my heels in. So I got quite tough, and, you know, you just learn to let stuff roll over you.
By its very nature, you are dealing with damaged people. When you're interviewing people, when you're telling their stories, is that something you have to learn as crime writers?
I still sit and cry sometimes. I pulled out on the last book. I put it on ice because one of the mothers was just so distraught on the phone that it made me wonder if maybe I couldn't do it. Because you sort of go through the journey listening, and, you know, I would never say, oh, I was on that journey with you, because you're never on that journey. And I really resent journalists who say that. Mm. Oh, I was on that journey with them all the way through. No, you were not. Mm. You were, no one is walking in their shoes. You are listening to how it was for them, but you are not. You have no idea what it's like. Don't presume. Because I covered courts for so many years, in court, you're an invisible player. In court, you're an observer. As a watcher, there is no room for emotion. Your focus is different. Your focus is on, am I doing a reasonable job representing this story and this crime to a member of the public? I'd watched people breaking down, telling the most awful, heartbreaking stories. And sometimes I'd go home feeling dirty from it. You know, you stand under the shower and still feel dirty an hour later. And how do you sit at the tea table when your mum and dad say to you, and you're, what, 21, so what have you done today? And I think, how can I even begin to tell you? And I would start, and my mum would say, no, I can't hear it. I can't hear that.
Is there a camaraderie that develops between journalists because of that?
In the olden days, in the 70s, but there were few women covering court. Yeah. You know, there was a sort of belief that they'd train you and you would do fashion or women's page.
I remember, well, then you'd leave to have a baby anyway.
Yeah, so that's what I was told. Yeah. Oh, you're wasting our money training. You'll just have a baby and leave. But I was told that. Yeah. But I remember someone saying to me, and I was really offended once, I bet you'd love to do the women's page one of these days. And I thought, I never want to do. What is a woman's page? Yeah. I always loved crime.
Well, and statistically, it is we women who love true crime books.
Yeah,
you know,
I'd say
television,
so.
Television, we love it.
Yeah, I would say so. And I know when I was, all I wanted to do as a little girl was be a journalist. I wanted to be a reporter and wear a Mac, like a raincoat, English for Mac. Mac is English for raincoat. Yep. And I was going to wear a Mac and have a notebook and follow policemen around like Dixon of Dot Green. I used to watch Dixon of Dot Green. And
that I don't even know what that is, but hearing the title of that in your accent, I feel like
Bobby.
I can visualise it.
So I wanted to be one of those pesky, annoying, intrusive people that wore a Mac. But there were always blokes in trilbies with cigarettes hanging off their lips. So I was going to be
it's
like
sort of
Nancy.
It's appealing, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's
like
appealing.
Nancy Drew, real detective book. But what I used to do is my mum and dad would go off to shopping, and when they went out, I used to go under dad's chair and dig out the British tabloids, the worst ones.
Yeah.
News of the World, the Sunday People. And then I would read all the crimes.
Yes.
With a little tiny pocket dictionary, and I would look up words like dismembered, and I'd go, ooh, you know, disfigured, disemboweled,
yeah,
shallow grave. I had this repertoire by the time I was about 9, this really strange repertoire about corpses found in shallow graves and torso. I never knew what a torso was. And then I frightened myself and had nightmares over the torso.
I bet.
That I had read about. Then I'd have nightmares, and she would come in and say, you're not reading Nancy Drew anymore. You're scary. And it wasn't Nancy Drew. It was the News of the World.
Little did she know, it was far more explicit than Nancy Drew.
Yeah. So wow. I had that sort of fascination, I think from quite young, is how could anyone do that,
yes,
to anyone else? And how could they think they'd get away with it? So when I started on the paper, I started with Magistrates Court. And in those days, you had to train really well. So you weren't let loose on the public.
Right.
You know, so I would go to court with a very senior reporter called Debbie Knox or Norma Smith, my mentors, and a guy called Pete Johnson. And they would write the story, and I would be allowed to ghost it, but it would never see print. Mm. So I would, and in those days, we wrote on typewriters.
Typewriters.
And toilet paper, it looked like. So your intro was on sheet one, and then your second paragraph, for the printer to print in big letters.
Yeah.
And then your second paragraph was on sheet two, so less big letters. And then the rest of it just followed on what looked like
toilet
paper.
So you wrote articles that were never printed?
At first. So yeah. Debbie would write it. I would write mine, and they'd go, ah, you know, and they'd go through, and the chief reporter, Ron, would say, oh, you just got sued in like 3 different places. You know, no. And then they'd tell me what I'd done wrong.
Can I ask a stupid question? Were you paid?
Oh, yes, I was being paid.
So this is why, like, never today would any organisation pay, knowing we're not going to use their work for a while. Don't be ridiculous.
Oh, but what I was doing was what it was all learning on the job. So it's like a degree on the newspaper. So I, the first thing
we... But now they'd want you to do that for free, wouldn't they? That's called being an intern.
Yes,
being now.
An intern. Everywhere. Yeah. Work
so
experience.
They sent us to a newspaper school, 12 recruits a year, 2 girls. Mm. And they would give us, we learned to touch type. So I was the fastest typer and the fastest at shorthand. And they told me I would make a very good secretary. And I should leave. And I was going to anyway, because they were going to kick me out. Yeah. But we did media law, which we had to pass exams in. So we knew the go, but we didn't.
Yeah.
We thought we knew the law until we got it wrong again and again. And then you learn very quickly what you can say. Then after a few months, they'd send me off to Magistrates Court on my own, check my stories very carefully, and all was good. And you learn very quickly, because I was neurotic about getting it wrong. As I got more skilled at it, more competent, I then graduated to County Court and Supreme Court and Court of Appeal. So I would go with a colleague to a very big high-profile trial, and it was all very ceremonial with the jury sworn in, and then the 12 lords and ladies that were like local dignitaries, and they'd all sit in as well. And we used to have a laugh on the press bench where we'd say, who will go green first? We'd watch the lords and ladies, who were just dignitaries, while they opened the grossest cases. And you could see them going like, and they'd put evidence, hand evidence photos around. You could see people going green. And I was always very successful at picking the jury foreman. We used to have a bet with the police who's going to, but we'd cover the case, and I would run out and I would read it straight off my notes to a girl in a head office who had headphones typing it down.
Yeah.
I'd go in and my colleague would say, what was your last paragraph? And I'd tell him, and he'd run out and he'd pick the story up from what I'd just missed that he'd heard. And we'd work in tandem.
Tag team.
All day.
That's amazing. So the article in the end
was a combination
covered
of both.
The whole day because between you saw it all while
old
the other
fashioned.
Was out reporting down the phone.
Yeah, so sometimes he'd do the start.
I never knew that. That's amazing.
Yeah, that's how we worked. And then at lunchtime we'd get our heads together and go, ooh. And it's awful. I'd run out and say, I've got the best case, you know, the best story. And then you'd have to stop and think, this is someone's life.
Do you have to develop a dark sense of humour?
Yeah. You know, my take on it, my way of dealing with it, I remember once doing a really awful serial rape case.
Yeah.
And I remember looking at this guy smiling in the dark, like, could have been pictures really, could have been on the bus, totally unfazed by this graphic evidence that was going down. And I looked at him and I thought, oh my God, you look so ordinary. I could have sat by you on the train today.
Yeah.
I could have sat by you in the bus. You could have come around my house to fix my electrics and I'd have made you a drink. Anybody's with the right baggage and the wrong background and a certain level of damage, we're all capable of being driven to pretty big extremes. You know, people that say, if anyone hurt my kids, I'd get them. I can understand that feeling. I guess the difference is people might have the thought but never go there.
But you specialise in that in your books. You specialise in sort of reconstructing the normality of these perpetrators. We can't recognise these people oftentimes before they do these things, can we?
You can't, and I just think hindsight's such a gift.
Yeah.
You can look back and see indicators that you, when it's all gone down, yeah, they all make sense now. But at the time, people, when they're in distress, talk a load of rubbish and make all sorts of wild threats, but you never really imagine that they're capable of doing them. But people are capable, especially... I remember doing a case, it's a really well-known case here in Melbourne, and it was a case of a woman called Margaret Raby. Mm-hmm. And she, I think, was the first case where they introduced battered woman syndrome as a defence. Ah. She stabbed a very abusive, very, very abusive, violent, abusive husband. And the things that he did degraded her in every way, forced her to have sex in the car outside the local primary school so people could... Other parents would see her and say, what a slut. He vomited on her and made her wear her clothes. Wouldn't let her change. He wouldn't let her wash her hair. He wouldn't let her sleep. That, Amnesty have identified sleep deprivation as a major form of torture.
Yeah.
He wouldn't let her leave the house. It got to the stage where he didn't even have to lock the door because she wouldn't dare leave the house. Mm. It's that sort of hostage syndrome. She had the works. And in the end, she stabbed him to death. I think she stabbed him. And... she was then tried for murder.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking that case for me typifies what you might be driven to if enough, basically it was him or her. He'd said to her, next time you do that, I'm going to kill you. And because he'd come so close to it, he'd injured her so many times, put her in hospital. She believed that. So when she acted firmly believing this was her next beating, was going to be her last. So you can actually understand. Mm. People think they won't get into those sort of relationships. Oh, and I think women, especially on juries, women are your worst nightmares on juries.
They can be quite harsh critics.
Yeah.
Like, why did she end up with him?
And why didn't she leave? I think really only in the last 12 months has there been some really serious rebuttal of the why doesn't she just leave. Firstly, we know now very clearly that that's actually the most dangerous time for women in a violent relationship. But traditionally, that has been really hard for other women to cop, hasn't it?
Well, I think you get... Karen Bell covered that really well in that case where the husband murdered Ingrid's children and father stabbed them to death on the driveway of his home. He actually did that whilst Ingrid was at the police station reporting him for yet another breach of the intervention order in which he raped her.
Yeah.
He'd breached the order by raping her. She'd gone to the hospital to be examined and to report it. Mm. And she really feared for her life. But in the meantime, by the time the police took her home with a view to arresting the violent husband, Peter Paulson, the grandfather, died protecting the two little children who he stabbed to death on the drive.
Oh, my God.
Ingrid said in one of her speeches on White Ribbon Day, people try to, women especially, will try and make themselves different. Mm-hmm. That couldn't happen to me. Mm-hmm. That couldn't happen to me because I would never marry anyone like that. That couldn't happen to me because if anyone threatened me like that, I'd leave straight away. That couldn't happen to me because... So they look for all these differences when in actual fact, she says, what we should be looking for are the similarities because what is the common factor that is likely to put you at greatest risk of violence is being female. You know, there are commonalities. And she did leave straight away.
Yeah.
The minute he became violent and abusive, she thought, I can't let my children see this, and left. But then the follow-up was not there for her. So you, especially with rape victims, you get people saying, well, what was she thinking of being out that late at night? What was she thinking of dressing like that? What
well, certainly when it's your husband raping you. I mean, that's still a stigma that
it is
you can't rape your own wife is still a belief that a lot of people carry.
And I talked to a woman the other day and she was telling me what she was talking about was what I would call the most taboo domestic violence. And the most taboo domestic violence is rape and sexual assault, sexual coercion.
Mm.
And so this guy was forcing her to have, basically he was prostituting her. He was forcing her to have sex with strangers that he would ring up and put an advert on the internet and they'd come into the house and he would force her to have sex with these people and he would watch. She became so frightened of that she would pretend she'd had calls and then she hadn't. And then when the guy didn't turn up, because he was never going to turn up, she would say, oh, he didn't turn up. But she said afterwards, you can go to the police and say, I've got a black eye, he beat me, or he trashed the house, he scared the kids, the neighbours heard him. But how do you say he forced me to have sex with other men when you can't prove that it's what he says, what she and what the third party said? Well, she was willing. How can she prove that? So a lot of that kind of sexual violence against women goes unreported because what evidence have you got to support it?
And it probably happens so much more.
Oh, so much more.
Than we think. In do you think with all the cases you've covered, is there a build-up with this kind of behaviour from the men? Is there anything you've noticed about how it kind of starts to evolve? That a lot of cases you read about, they seem very charming at first, they're very doting, but almost a bit obsessive, like, where have you been? What are you doing? I need to know where you are at all times. What's your opinion about sometimes how this behaviour plays out and builds up?
It crosses socioeconomic boundaries for a start, so that if you've got that view that this is only happens to poor, downtrodden, damaged women, forget it. And it's harder in some cases for those well-to-do, comfortably off professional women to admit that their husband, who's a lawyer or a policeman, is doing the very same thing to them. Now, even harder to ring their colleagues at the local police station and say, come around and pick him up, he's just raped me. How do you... And you know no one's going to believe you. But I think that there is a progression in as much... In all the cases in this last book that I did, the guys were very charming, they were very personable. Kevin East had a great job. And there's a sort of difference in age in some of the cases too, quite a difference where the men were older and picked pretty young, impressionable young women. But Michelle Steck was a very smart, very savvy young 19-year-old. And it started off really slowly where he became irrationally jealous. He didn't want to go in anywhere. Then she got pregnant and the balance of power immediately shifted where he's in charge of the money now. He decides what she can have and what she can't have. So she's sort of on the back foot. And then when the baby's born, he's jealous of the attention that she gives to the baby.
And reading your books and reading about so much family violence, it made me realise how vulnerable we become when we have a baby, we women. Suddenly having that other life to protect, how that can change the balance of power in any relationship.
Well, it's financial. Immediately you're at a financial disadvantage, but it's also that you will protect. So Dione Ferring, who's a former husband, Jason Dalton, who was the One Nation candidate, her second child was a product of rape.
Wow.
And she lay silent and endured that assault because she had a tiny tot sleeping in the cot next to her. In some of the cases, there was that belief, maybe once we have a baby, he'll change.
Absolutely.
The violence is also that abuse in some of these cases was Cindy, for example, Cindy Gambino, when I interviewed her, I said, was it an abusive marriage? Oh, no. No, it wasn't abusive. He never laid a hand on me or the kids.
Well, this is why she struggled for so long to accept and believe that her husband, Rob Farquharson, drove their children into a dam.
And murdered them on Father's Day. But she, but when I got into it, you know, I did a lot of interviews with Cindy over a long period of time, over 8 years. I would ask her certain questions and she'd say, oh yeah, he did that. Mm. And I'd say, but that's family violence. Was it? He didn't hit me.
Mm.
You know, he would do things like, she used to like to go to line dancing. It's a little thing, but it was her outlet. So he, on the night that she went to line dancing, he wouldn't change the baby. He wouldn't feed the baby. She knew as she came back, the baby would have a very sore bottom and a nappy rash. So it made her not want to go. So it's a subtle control.
And you don't want to leave your child in that situation because when you have a baby, you're just like,
that's
I can't
what I mean.
Even.
It makes us so vulnerable,
it's like
doesn't
you
it?
Diminish, you see these women diminishing themselves to protect their children and it's...
And yet other women, when there's a female perpetrator, can be a nightmare.
And even with the female victim.
Really?
Yes. You know, they look at their own lives. And they'll say, what was she doing out that late?
Wow.
What on earth was she thinking of going there anyway? And she'd been drinking.
Oh.
I remember interviewing Lillian Leader QC, very prominent barrister in Melbourne who died some years ago, interviewing her about the jury system. And I'd covered a case where this Czech guy, it was where drug rape was a new crime.
Yeah.
And he'd been spiking drinks. So he'd have a girlfriend who he had a full sexual relationship with. There was some perverse satisfaction that he got, a power that he got. So he would drug their drinks with Rohypnol.
Mm.
They would have no memory. He'd get them back to the apartment where he would photograph or film himself raping them. He would photograph them in various poses, holding a rose. Those women had no idea that he'd done this. It came to light because he used to carry a briefcase around with a padlock on, almost attached to him. And he had a new girlfriend who used to watch him going in the shower with the briefcase and he'd keep
it's very weird.
You know, he'd keep it in sight and he'd never let it out of his sight. And one day, for I don't know what happened, he left the briefcase and she forced it open and there were all these images of, well, what looked to her dead women.
Oh, God.
So she thought they were murders and she freaked out And she went to the police. And there was a massive investigation because no one knew who these women were.
Oh, God. And the women didn't even know that they had been attacked.
No, they didn't know.
Wow.
So often he was careful and they'd be photographed from the neck down, so you didn't have a face. But the police did a meticulous investigation. They pieced all this evidence bit by bit by bit. Mm. One of the stories I did was she was a former girlfriend who I tracked down to Queensland, and the police said they turned up on her doorstep and said, "Is this you?"
Oh, God.
And she recognised her rings and her jewellery, and she said, I've no memory. But she then could remember the sort of instance when it could have happened came back to her,
yeah,
where she had a weekend away with him at Blair Gowrie, and she felt unwell all that weekend, and she didn't really remember. She was a bit dazed, didn't remember, just remembers going to bed feeling sick, didn't really remember too much, feeling dizzy, doesn't remember anything after that. They were able to piece it together, but during the trial, one of the victims came to court, and she'd been a heroin addict. She'd got a drug background. And you could see the women on the jury, you know, heroin addict. You could see their faces, heroin, yep, addict. Well, what'd she expect? You know, there was so little sympathy. And she was actually quite a strong young woman, I think, because there were all these naked photos of her with her legs apart, sprawled across the desk on the barrister's table when they all went out for lunch. She came back from lunch and she said to me, "Those photographs have been just left open. Like, we've just like called it a day, adjourned for lunch. There's photographs of me with my legs spread for just about anyone to look at. Yes, the jury has shown them, but just anyone." I said, "Complain."
Yes.
"They're all so busy doing their job, they've forgotten this is you."
That's right.
"And you have every right to voice a complaint to the court." And she really complained. "Oh, how dare they do this? I'm already victimised.
Yes.
I'm a victim. And this is just adding to my victimisation." Anyway, she made quite a statement. And after that, they were very carefully put away. Anyway, he was found guilty. But I remember thinking after that, I then went to see Lillian Leader. Lillian Leader is the QC.
Right.
I said, "There were all men on that jury. How awful for those poor young women,
yeah,
to have to give the kind of evidence they gave in front of an all-male jury." And she said, "You'd want an all-male jury. You'd be surprised how less judgmental men are,
yeah,
than women. They will think, that could be my daughter. Whereas women will think, my daughter would never do that."
Yes.
You know, so it was an interesting conversation. She said, "You know, it's a system that works. It's the best we have."
Yeah, but it's not perfect.
Nothing's perfect,
yeah,
but it's the best we have. And I took that away with me.
Mm.
And I've looked at the balance where people have been stood down. You know, it's interesting who they will stand down, who they will challenge, who they prefer to have. You know, you're never going to get it right.
Mm.
I couldn't be on a jury. I could not be on a jury because if they did not say in the first 5 seconds, "This is a man of impeccable character. He has never been in any trouble before. This defendant has never," I would think, priors, history, guilty.
Yeah.
So I couldn't be on. And I remember my dad being on a jury years ago, and it sort of sticks in my mind. I was a teenager and he came home. My dad's really like Welsh and really struggles to keep a secret because they're storytellers in my family. And he would come home and sat at the dinner table. He goes, "No one asked me. No one asked me about our case because I can't tell
That's so Welsh.
Anything about my case, even if I wanted to. So no one asked him." And he said, "As I said, even if I wanted to."
Yeah, I'd be dying to tell you everything
about
that happened
this case because I can't. And I write. And then after a bit, I said, "So what stage are you at the case? Like, is it nearly over?" And he said, "Well, we've heard our side."
Our side?
Our side being the police. No, it's no smoke without fire.
Oh, funny.
So he said, "Oh, guilty of sin." This is halfway through. And I'm thinking, all of those things you learn, don't you?
Yeah.
And I would watch a jury, especially in a case like a fraud case,
mm,
especially if you've got like a smart-looking, young, attractive woman on trial, because women are really good at fraud. Women are really good at deception, really,
yeah,
good. And you'd see the jury, you know, take it, because they say, don't you, make an impression in the first 5 seconds,
yeah,
or something. I can remember we had this lovely young journalist that joined us years ago in England in my newsroom called Lucy. And I really had a lot of time for Lucy because we'd been like the new brigade of women coming in, and you had to work twice as hard to get half as far, you know.
Yeah.
But she came with me to an inquest dressed in a see-through blouse and a short skirt. And so the chief reporter had to say, "Lucy, you can't wear that to an inquest." Their attitude to her, though, they judged her on that. And I remember,
yeah,
thinking, that is what happens in court, yeah, to victims. You're told, don't wear that. You know,
yeah,
why, does that make you less of a victim then?
You know, the more you've talked about this, I just keep thinking about Belinda Murphy. Jaden, yes. Leskie's mum.
Oh, yeah.
She just keeps popping into my mind. I've got shivers down my spine now thinking about how bitchy I was about her, how I was one of those people who thought, oh, well, what does she expect? You know, like, what kind of person is she, and who's she hanging out with, and who's she leaving a kid with? And she's out at a pub with God, and, you know, and judgmental of the whole family. And now as an older,
yes,
hopefully wiser woman,
yes,
I think about this girl who came home to find her baby was dead, or her baby was missing at that stage, and everything that girl went through.
And she was grieving. At that time, I covered that case, and there was another baby that went missing. And the other case was a case at Doncaster of a young mum who came home with a brand new baby and a lady posing as a health visitor. She was desperate for a baby, and she went to the house. And what she'd done was she trawled the birth notices.
Wow.
So she sort of knew when you were going home from hospital. So she turned up and said, I'm the new health visitor, and I've come to check on the baby. And she checked on the baby, and she lit candles in the house, and she drugged mum. And she nicked the baby, and basically the house could have burned down. I'm not sure whether there was a fire or something happened to attract attention, but the baby had gone.
Wow.
And then there was a hunt for the baby. Now, that young mum, in that case, that respectable woman from Doncaster, that poor mother had outpouring of sympathy because her baby was missing, feared dead. And eventually the baby was returned. And the lady that took the baby, who I'd also interviewed some years before for Woman's Day, one of those magazines, and she got this tragic, heartbreaking story of how she had a baby as a very young girl, and she was forced to hide in the house while she was pregnant, and the baby was taken and given away. So she got a whole lot of baggage. Given the right circumstances, you're capable of anything. And she did this desperate thing. She pretended, faked her pregnancy and nicked a baby. Anyway, that mother, whose baby was stolen, got all the outpouring of sympathy from the whole of the country. Poor Belinda Murphy, who was, you know, that woman from Maui.
That bogan.
Yep. Going out drinking when you got a baby. Like,
oh,
what
and
are
the
you
Pig's
doing?
Head gang and the whole sort of, oh, we don't live like that and they're different to us.
Exactly.
And,
but she was still just as much a victim.
Oh,
I remember,
absolutely.
I remember talking with a criminologist called Judy Wright, and we talked about it, and she said, you know, that colourful assortment, you know, the defence were really smart. He was really smart, that defence lawyer. He confused people by parading a colourful assortment of characters that you need to make yourself different from, and it sort of distracted everybody. Could have been anybody by the time he'd finished.
It was the greatest show on earth, wasn't it?
It really was.
And we kept having to be reminded a baby died, a toddler died.
A little baby died. New Idea used to run stories. I didn't write those stories, but I remember reading the stories. Even the way the stories were written didn't really generate sympathy for her, you know. I'd read the stories and think, I think you're missing the point.
Yeah.
You know, because they were focused on, it was almost going for the garish. You know, here she is with a new husband, a new child, finding happiness again. Nothing she does will ever write her life. It would the grief.
The tears I've cried for Cindy Gambino, whose children died on Father's Day in their dad's car. I look at Cindy and I think, how are you surviving? And somehow I've never looked at Belinda that way.
I've often wondered.
Why don't I?
I've often wondered how. And I did another baby. I don't know if you remember this case. Anita Ciancio was married to Joseph Barbaro. The Barbaro name will ring a bell because
absolutely.
He's part of the Barbaro family that were involved with the Morans.
And the Calabrian guys.
And it's all
Keith Moore would
that's where I know about that.
So it's all the family had these links with this underbelly scene, which was on the telly at the time. The gangland wars were in the paper all the time.
Yeah.
It was more the reporting of, you know, another body every day, you know.
Yeah.
So these wars were upping momentum in Melbourne.
Yeah.
And what happened was Anita came out of hospital with tiny little new baby daughter, and she'd had a cesarean and she was not well.
Yeah.
But she decided to go to the shops at Deer Park and take the little one with her. And she said it was about 4 p.m, it was getting a bit quiet, but she could feel herself being observed. And she looking around, she sees a shady looking guy and his wife or partner, and they seemed to be watching her, and she was a bit worried. So she thought there might be muggers or something. Mm-hmm. She didn't know what they were watching. So she takes the baby back to the car, is in the process of strapping the baby in the baby capsule, when suddenly she's punched and attacked, and she still thought it was a mugging. So she's chucking them the handbag, and they kick her between the legs.
Oh, God.
And she's had a cesarean. She's just given birth. The baby's like a week old. And in the middle of all this, she realises it's the baby they're after.
Oh, my
God. They grab the baby. They make off with the baby. This sparked a massive news break all over Melbourne where, is it gangland related? Was it reprisal related?
Mm.
The police were immediately looking for the baby. The media were asking, is this gangland related? Anita was Absolutely distraught.
Yeah.
Who cares whether it's, you know, yes, the baby's been stolen, she's a new mum, get the baby back. Immediately the connection's made. Obviously because they're thinking it might be gangland related, but what if it wasn't? And it wasn't. You've got the police looking for the culprits. You've got the family suspecting it might be gangland related and they're making their own inquiries. Uh-huh. And the associates are also making their own inquiries. So basically the police need to find that baby before they do. Before they find who took the baby. In the meantime, the twits that took it, and they really were dumb and dumber, they took the baby, shaved the baby's head because she had distinctive thick dark hair.
Oh, a mop of hair,
And again, this was another crazy couple from up in north central Victoria that wanted a baby, and they just saw her with the baby and thought, bingo. Not realising whose baby they'd stolen.
Oh my God!
So then you're
it's
in.
Terrifying.
Then you're in.
I'm freaking out.
So how would you be if you were really not that smart, and you'd gone off and randomly stolen a baby that turned out to be linked to
the Calabrian mafia in Australia?
You would really struggle to give that baby back quick. I'm onto the story, so I go out to visit the family, and I saw Anita. And I don't care what their links are. She was to me an absolutely distraught, beside herself mother.
Yeah.
The pain was palpable. I think that's one of the stories I've gone into where I could have sat and cried.
Yeah, I bet.
And I had to go out because I was thinking, can you even imagine what you'd be going through? The baby had been gone all night. Oh. And it was like, where's the baby? Where's the baby? Anyway, after some days, I don't even remember it. A jogger jogging through some inner suburb of Melbourne passed a derelict building, heard what sounded like kittens. And it was a cold winter morning. It was really cold and she thought it sounded like kittens and she ran past and went back and she went into the house and there on lying on rubble amongst broken glass where there was vermin and everything, she found a tiny baby.
Oh my God.
In a jumpsuit with no blanket. It wasn't carefully wrapped. It wasn't basically had they dumped the baby to die? I don't know.
Yeah.
Anyway, the baby was found and I was there when the baby came back. Anita rang me and she said they're bringing the baby, found the baby, and she couldn't bath it. She just couldn't bath that baby enough. Bath that baby. And she was crying and her hair had gone. And we were there doing a magazine story, you know, my baby returned. Her relief was like nothing. And she couldn't let that baby, no one could hold the baby. It was like, give me the baby. The baby had been to hospital and had hypothermia, but was fine now. But, you know, we're doing this photo shoot and Joseph Barbara goes, I'm off to the magistrate's court. You know, we're not now. We're going to see this. You know, they wanted to go to court. Now I ball the culprits. The woman that stole the baby ended up getting more compensation because she got bashed up in Deer Park jail than Anita got for the trauma. And believe me, the trauma went on. So when I went to see her a year later, I just rang her up one day.
It would never leave that trauma, I don't think.
Left her.
Yeah.
So I went to see her maybe. And I rang her up and I said, how are you? And she was crying and she was depressed. She was anorexic.
PTSD.
She couldn't go out. Mm. She was refusing to let the older little girl go. She didn't want her to go to school because she was so frightened that so she became very housebound. In the meantime, the story goes into the magazine where other women come forward saying, he's got a baby. He's my lover. I've got his love child.
Oh, my God.
So then we've got a procession of people coming up with babies that belong to Joseph Barbaro saying, oh, I'm the mother of his child. I'm the mother of his child. And then he gets arrested and banged up. So he's taken to... So Anita, basically right when she needed him, he was arrested for unrelated offences, taken off to New South Wales and locked up. And that left Anita dealing with a baby that had been stolen, dealing with a little child she couldn't let out of her sight, not able to eat, not able to sleep, totally, totally traumatised on her own. And there was so little sympathy because, her husband's like got all these girlfriends and now he's been locked up.
Again, the victim carries some guilt somehow in our eyes.
That woman went to hell and back. And I think of all the victims and I often think of her, my heart broke for her.
Yeah.
What she dealt with was dreadful in the extreme. But the way she was literally left, cut adrift and left to get on with it. And the woman that took the baby got more compensation than Anita got for what she went through and still went through for years and probably still is. I wouldn't mind betting.
Listening to the two of you, I know, because it does it to me, it ignites this like, I want to be a crime writer. What would you say to people who are listening who want to write true crime books and want to report crime and are passionate about it? Can you make an income out of it these days?
It's like the best job in the world. Yeah. Megan's actually the reason I wrote my first true crime book because we worked out I was a very, very young journo, a new idea, and like had no idea what I was doing basically back then.
For me then, it wasn't a popular thing to do.
No.
It wasn't popular. Most of the complaints to the newspaper were to do with court stories. I'd get hysterical mothers ringing up saying, you called my son a monster. And I think, no, I didn't. The judge called him a monster. He killed four people. Yeah. He's a monster. But yeah. I didn't call him a monster. Yeah. I reported a judge calling him a monster. So every day, every night, we had complaints. When I worked for Leader Newspapers, Steve Foley, who was the editor-in-chief, had a box for all my letters of complaint, which I would go in and we'd go through them and there'd be loads. And it got nasty too. It got quite nasty. Yeah. And then I covered a case of child abuse where the mother at Ferntree Gully threatened to burn my house down and threatened to burn down the probation officer's house down. And I got the police on my doorstep saying, you haven't seen her hanging around? It's like, no. And, well, she did actually go around and have a go at the probation officer. So I got a bit scared then. Wow. So that was when I then decided maybe not having a name on things was a very good idea. I think there's a danger, like CSI shows have made forensic science courses, criminal crime investigation. It's become a really popular course now at universities and things. Yes. And they don't want to just be journalists anymore. They want to be crime writers. And I think in order to be a good crime writer, you've got to be a really careful journalist. And I think that you become better at writing crime because you can relate to people with more life experience. I'm a much better journalist at nearly 60 and less judgmental. I like ferreting. I think that's the biggest part of my job.
It's the fun bit, but it's the bit that makes no money too. It's isn't it? It's like the fun bit is the process.
It is.
If you got paid for it, I would have made so much money.
Yeah, me too.
When I met Emily, I remember Emily popping up on the scene. I'd be at Women's Day Camp. Then they'd all move to New Ideas, so I go there. Then they'd all move back again, so I go back there. And I'd pop around. And sometimes I work with Patrice Vigin, my friend, and we'd work together. And then when we weren't working together, we were neurotically spying on each other because we didn't know what's she doing? I'll bet she's doing that.
It was a crazy, women's magazines are pretty.
But Emily came on the scene as a youngster at New Idea, and I was at Woman's Day then with Patrice, and we were like, who's she? Who's this young girl? She's good.
A nobody.
But she was coming up with some really good stuff and we were like, oh, she's good. Like, better watch her.
So
there's another one to add to our watch, add to our watch list, you know. But when Emily came to talk to me about one of my crime, True Blood, I think, and she came to do a review on True Blood, and I just said, you should be doing this. Like, you could do this. The most enduring thing I remember about that meeting with her was her passion. It was the same, you recognise passion.
Yeah.
I don't know that you can train people.
No, you're right.
You can train people to write, but can you train them to have a really good news sense? I think you can hone it as you get older, but you've either got it or you don't.
Yeah, definitely.
And it's passion, you've either got it or you don't. And frankly, I know a lot of journalists who have lost their passion and they should get out. You've got to do every story justice. And those people that they're reliving the most awful moments of their life with you, that's a privilege. And if they can do that with you, you should do them the justice of doing the best job you can, I think. And if you don't, you're shortchanging them and yourself. I always let people read what I've written. After my son got better from cancer, I went back to work with a totally different approach. I'd been a mother with a kid with cancer on a cancer ward for 2 years. Media came in while I was there and I'm thinking, you're looking for the sickest kid on a drip with the baldest head. I know what you're doing. And I remember bossing some young journalist around saying, do not call this story. There was a new Ronald McDonald ward at Monash. Do not say it's a ward for dying children. Do not use the word dying. Mm. This is a ward for seriously ill children. Do not use the word terminal or you'll rob these kids of hope. So after I went back to work and I specialised in victim, I would cover the court case, but I would do the victim's story at the end. The survivors, I like to call them, not victims. And I would say, I have no issue with you reading your story when I've written it, before it goes to the news desk. And if there is anything in there you think I've misrepresented, anything there that really distresses you, that you wish you hadn't said, or something you wish to add, we will fix it up and we will then send it to the magazine. And in the contract, it will say you have final copy approval. So if anyone in there tweaks and decides to wave a wand and elaborate, you can say, that's not what I agreed to. You lose a child like Cindy lost three. You're an ordinary person plunged into the public spotlight in extraordinary circumstances. You've got the world's media on your doorstep, talking to your neighbours, raking through your life. Then the trial goes on. Every photo of you grieving, coming in and out of court is taken. You've got no control over any of it. And suddenly you're telling your story. At least if you can have a journalist who will offer you a little control over the way that story is interpreted, if you can give people at least that control over how their own story is told, then I think you're doing your job.
That's the incomparable Megan Norris. To find out more about her books, just check out our Facebook page, Australian True Crime, with Michelle Laurie and Emily Webb. And you can also buy Emily's True Crime books there by hitting the Shop Now button.
Thank you for downloading our Australian True Crime podcast. If you have an Australian True Crime story of your own you'd like to share with us, let us know on our Facebook page. We'd love to hear from you.
We'd also love it if you'd give us a nice review and 5 stars on iTunes.
Thank you to Sherry Laurie, Michael Davern, Kieran Simpson and Alex Loran for their help in pulling this project together. We'll be back with more Australian True Crime next week. Until then, stay safe.